This is a public service from the Vancouver Media Co-op. Please consider becoming a Media Co-op sustainer at vancouver.mediacoop.ca.
Thank you for facing the world and braving a nice evening to come here. There's a lot of you here. I have assembled a bunch of shit that I don't really know what I'm going to do with. Over the years, I've been reading and fetishizing this Onto Ottawa Trek stuff. It seems to have come to head now that it's some type of anniversary. There's various forces out in the world trying to capture what we can from this historical event. And I find myself, time and time again, valorizing a lot of these efforts without really putting it in a real kind of continuum of struggle. Seeing what these things were able to transcend, or more importantly, recognizing the inherent failures of this type of demand-laden strategy of social conflict. And if there was to be a textbook of demand-orientated conflict, I think we could look at the 30s and see in this revolutionary context both a motivating force that took people forward, by people I mean thousands, tens of thousands of people in the streets of Vancouver, out on the streets, creating a real popular front in the streets, confronting the police, conflicting with whomever, but at the same time, with those demands, falling into the ancient booby trap of leadership, the ancient, or not so ancient now, with the Bolshevik Revolution, taking on a communist leadership, a very Bolshevik leadership, and all of these things. So before I start jabbering about that stuff, I'm going to try to orientate myself to the real presentation I wanted to make, also keeping in mind that my roadmap that I had made this morning for the thing tonight, I just didn't bring it at all. So if there was going to be any slinging it, now it's for real. What I want to do is show off some slides that I made and read accounts of people, the motherfucking people who were in the shit, who did the shit. When we read all this, when we go back without much of a perspective, oh, did I put these upside down? I think we often find ourselves reading directly from the leadership or police reports or the media reports. Hopefully, that's not what happens. You think so? Is that going to make it better? You like that? Can people see it? Can you see their shoes? What I'm going to do, because I'm a little bit nervous, is just read from some shit. That was the idea anyways. And in my reading of these accounts, I hope to share some thoughts I had when I was reading them all alone on my shitter or wherever, Frollo shitter. So I just brought a bunch of books, the books that I was reading. 10 Lost Years, I don't know if you've seen this book, you can get it at any used bookstore for like 99 cents, and it's like the deal of the used bookstore. This guy wrote a few things, he went around, talked to like a million people, and didn't give them any credit, just took these, like, just created these montages of monologues, threw them all together, not really in any type of coherent chapter-like system, and just said, like, here's what people were thinking then. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And most of the shit, most of the real critical shit that I've been able to find has come from this. So really, to kind of start this discussion about the 30s, I wanted to talk first about what maybe comes to our minds when we think of the 30s, and that's the hobos. The hobos riding the rails and the jungles, all these type of romanticized fairy tale ideals. Right on, fucking right. Power to the people.
Sorry, I'm late.
Just on time. Well, the revolution will not be on time.
The revolution will not be caffeinated.
Whoa.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm really
No, it's
sorry.
Okay. No, you gave me a perfect opportunity to drink. So I'm going to quickly read a couple things from a couple hobos. And you've got to realize this. In the relief camps of the 30s, we weren't treated as humans. We weren't treated as animals either, but I always thought we were just statistics written in some big ledger in Ontario. I headed for Vancouver, where at least I wouldn't freeze to death, But we were harassed there and kicked around, so I joined up with a relief camp that freezes to death. That was like a slogan that brought a lot of people out west, was at least there you'll die of starvation before you freeze to death. And I think that's still a motto that many have on their way to Victoria. You fucking bore yourself to death there. Okay, so here's the hobo, you know, whatever, he goes to the relief camp. It was one of the several of the old, one of the camps in Hope Princeton Trail, made up of board and canvas tents and buildings they called cabooses, where we slept. There was about 150 of us in this one, guys as young as 16, up to 35 or 45, I should guess. And the thing was, we were all single, had no jobs, stony broke, and no future, and the politicians considered us as dangerous. Their thinking was that if we were isolated, then we wouldn't be hanging around vacant lots and jungles listening to communist troublemakers. The truth is, nobody really paid any attention to those agitators. They were more than a laugh than anything. I've had people laugh in my face. Who the hell cared about saving the world out there when there's no world to save right here for ourselves? He goes on. You know, it was mostly the guys from the relief camps north and east of Vancouver who were on the Ottawa March, which wound up in the Regina riot. That wasn't no riot, just to get that established. Anticlimactic by the time we get there. It wasn't a riot in the sense that those guys, the guys that we met in the relief camps, if they had been in charge, then we would have really seen some shit. Why, shit, if they had three good leaders, not those fucking Reds, but three guys who made a lot of sense and would have been up front with them, they would have taken Vancouver apart. Everything about those camps was wrong. But the thing most wrong was that they treated us like dirt, and we weren't. We were up against it, broke, tired, hungry. But we were farm boys who knew how to work, and so we were shit. Dirt. Slaves. I've said it before, we were slaves. What else could you call a man who's given 20 cents a day and is expected to believe their bullshit that he is an important part of the country? They just wanted us out of sight, and as far out of sight as they could manage. So in putting these guys out of sight, the government, through various laws, various mechanisms of internment that they had already established in World War I, when, for example, they wanted to get rid of all the Ukrainians. Not all the Ukrainians. So there's a lot to be said about the Ukrainians being interned. But the one thing that's not often mentioned is that it was only the Ukrainians in a 15-mile radius of City Hall. So the urban proletarians, the urban proletarian Ukrainians were the ones who were interned. The others, if you're off in the fields, farming, whatever the fuck, you're all right. But if the potentiality of your existing in this urban domain conflicted with the interests of capital at the time, then you got put into one of these camps. This is a camp that the relief workers, that the homeless, if you want to call them that, the hobos, the down and out, were sent to. There's about 100 camps in the interiors of British Columbia in the most desolate wastelands, wherever they could, and they just had to do this ridiculous work. Cut this tree, move this tree over there, stand around, do this, do that. And as they're saying there, this guy's idea was that they wanted to isolate these bums in the middle of nowhere so that they couldn't be influenced by communism. But the communists, not being the smartest but smart enough, they figured, well, why don't we just go to the camps in the middle of nowhere and organize these guys? So they sent their best organizers into these camps, and then within like 5 minutes, totally created these Soviets out of each and every camp, federated it with a newsletter, poured in tons of money, their best organizers were sent in. The guys who were at first forced to do the slave labor, now they could, after repelling their guards, forcing them out sometimes with sticks, sometimes with bricks. There's instances of Molotov cocktails being used. It was the use of Molotov cocktails in the dry woods that got them free smokes in their ration. So by creating these social ruptures in these camps, they were able to in turn communize these camps. And by communize, you know, not necessarily set up a proletarian dictatorship or a central committee, although they kind of did those things. They started teaching one another, they started doing reading sessions, they started hanging out, they started talking about what was really fucking going on. And this gave them months and months and months to do this, to the point where they, when they finally decided, or their leadership, their imposed leadership decided that they were going to strike from these camps and go into the city, a lot of them didn't want to leave. They felt perhaps that they were on a human strike in these camps, that they had found, you know, what they'd been riding to and from on the rails from. It was some solidarity. It was some just to be able to sit and fucking smoke and drink. And, you know, not that I don't want to paint an entirely pretty picture. A lot of stories like in that 10 Lost Years has come out about the prison mentality that exists in some of these camps. Younger guys being taken advantage of, all that kind of shit. So again, in this history, it's, you got to be careful not to romanticize stuff. But in the broad strokes, we can use the positivity of the programs. They decided, like I say, there's an elected leadership. They decided that they were going to, as they said, pull the pin and let them have the works. Come into the city and use their fighting forces that they had mobilized in the camps and turn them loose into the metropolis of Vancouver, which is, you know, the kind of big booming city at this time. And their also idea was to support what was happening with all the other trade unions. Most importantly, if not the only real important labor strike that was happening right then was the dock workers union. You got to think all along the West Coast was just a revolutionary force that was consuming all of these docks. So all the shipments coming to and fro from Asia, from wherever the fuck, was being totally stalled by these communist pickets, street fights, cops getting killed left, right, and center. The hysteria of the politicians within America that obviously came up into Canada was that there's going to be a communist revolution, there's going to be a Bolshevik revolution, that it's imminent, that they're going to fucking hang us up with our fucking guts. And if this is allowed to establish itself in Vancouver, you know, it's going to be a real fighting force, and it's going to be nearly impossible to dislodge, because as a metropolis at that time, Vancouver was pretty isolated. You had the ability of troops to come in by train tracks, and we'll get to that. But besides that, you couldn't really, you know, bring in fighter planes and bomb Vancouver with the carpet bombing, which they eventually did over in Europe, or, you know, whatever. There was a real threat that this was going to happen. And as we look more into this, we see the potentiality, if not the threat, of this taking place. I'm just looking right now. I brought a bunch of books so I could quote these things, so you didn't just think I was like a nut. Should I just like read from these books, or is this okay if I just kind of like talk it through? A little bit of both? I think a little bit of both. Like I said, I had this really nice paper with like this book for this part, here's the page, and like I didn't bring it, so sorry, hold on. I was going to talk about them coming into the city, which is in my little red book, or my big little red book. No, I'm not going to talk about that part. I am going to talk about their organizing in the city. So they come into the city, they're in the camps, they decide on this day, whatever day, I can tell you any day, you'll probably believe me unless you know actually. So let's say like, what's before April? February. February the 11th. We're going to march. Who's the historian? We're going to go into the city, blah, blah, blah. We're going to declare a strike, and we're going to put forward that these demands, that we get welfare, at that time called relief, that you stop beating us, so on and so forth. Most of these demands were symbolic. They knew exactly the class war that they were engaged in, and they knew the conflict that would happen when they showed up by the thousands off of the freight trains that they all hopped from these camps and ended up in Vancouver. So they felt it... Oh, yeah, what? Maybe slide it? Oh, sorry, yeah, this is a good book. This is, I'm going to refer to it a lot, by Ronald Liversedge. He goes on to Spain. This is the first edition. Nice, eh? That's a beautiful cover, all that. I would have photocopied it, but my photocopier was just stolen by the state. Okay, so I was going to say they come into the city, they've got this organization, so they just have like a bunch of hobos in the woods. They go up there like, Now they come back in the city. They've just taken like 100 freight trains. They've come from all over BC. They converge, a convergence in Vancouver, ring a bell. They come in and they're now like getting off the trains, like marching in formation, like singing the International. They thought they're going to get rid of all these bums by sending them into the hotels of downtown Eastside. I mean, sending them to the relief camps in the interior of British Columbia. And now coming out of the hotels, I mean, coming from the interior, is all of these bums, like totally military formation and there to fuck shit up. So they're like, the cops have met them right away. Right off the bat, there's a couple fights. They say, we're going to need some organizing so that we can go out, spread the offensive, and try to make some traction as far as the demands and get support. So I'm going to read logistically some ideas of their organizing. Maybe not from that one. right? Okay. After a couple week of town, couple weeks in town, our divisions were organized into groups of 12 crews, with each group electing its own group leader, the move being endorsed after democratic discussion and a majority vote in favor. They mention this all the time, how democratic it was. There are many advantages to this type of organizing. One of the main ones being is that it was practically foolproof against the planting of provocateurs, which the cops and the RCMP, that was their bread and butter at this time. So this worked against planting provocateurs in our ranks. The groups always sat together at meetings, marched together on parades, worked together on strike duties, and came to spend their leisure time together. The men got to know each other and to trust each other in emergencies, and there was a loyalty and, help me pronounce this, esprit de corps?
Corps?
Did you hear that? A little bit louder? That's nice. I love French. Esprit de corps, built up in their groups. Many times when volunteers would be called for some job or other, a group leader would ask his group, "How about it, boys?" and receive a quick affirmation and volunteer his whole group. Leading to, we had a few department store parades, where each division would enter a different store simultaneously. So there's about a dozen different crews. They decide they're going to go out there, and each crew is going to take a department store. These store parades were for the purpose of informing the crowds and shoppers of our plight, inviting them to write to their federal member of parliament and demanding that the government open negotiations with us, and also to pressure the city and provincial authorities to grant us relief while we were awaiting negotiations. So that part there is important. The grant us relief while we were awaiting negotiations. So they had all gone into the slave camps because there was really no other options. There was laws that were put into place that weren't necessarily always enacted, kind of like our, the emergency shelter program. It's like the cops at whim can force you into a shelter. They don't always necessarily, because activists will guide you there. In this sense, it's like they could force you to the relief camps, but a lot of people were just going there for survival reasons, or activists were organizing them to do so. So in this strike, they had to make demands for temporary relief, a couple bucks to get something to eat, because at this time they're literally fucking starving in the downtown east side of Vancouver. Hobo jungles are sitting there eating rats, like things are pretty grim in the Depression era of Vancouver, kind of apocalyptic for a lot of people. So they're going to all these stores, they're doing this and that. Here and in a lot of instances, they're talking about how relatively peaceful it was, which mostly they'll account for. But when you read their police reports, often they're going in, the man is telling them they're not allowed in, there's a fight at the doors, some shit gets broken, some stuff gets thrown around, they go back out on the streets, parade around, this and that. Sorry, I have an ulcer in my beer. So an example of what it was really like when they went in to these stores, and definitely not an isolated incident, but I think kind of fitting for us because it deals with the Hudson's Bay Company, exactly 75 years before the heart attack march met the Hudson's Bay's front window. These guys, these rowdy boys, went to the Hudson's Bay on one of their parades. Sorry, it's a nice ring. Is it my phone? It's probably my phone.
I didn't want to interrupt by turning it off.
Nope. Perfect, because I had to find where this was. So they are on their way, hold on with me, into the Hudson's Bay. I lost my bookmark to this, so I might just have to tell the story. I'm just going to tell the story, sorry. But it really happened. So they're doing what's called a snake march. This was a very big thing for everybody. Hold on, I've got a picture. I made a picture. I hadn't found a picture of a snake march until I found this one. And I was pretty excited about it, so I'm not going to, hold on. I was talking about those relief camps. Here's a relief camp. It's kind of chilling, hanging out, reading the Communist Manifesto. It's all good. So there was 100 relief camps kind of spread out all over Canada, but they were concentrated in BC because BC has had a history of interning people in our desolate wilderness, coincidentally, usually running upside the ridges of reserves. So kind of when you see a map, and I've worked on this, I've put it together a map of the internment camps of the Ukrainians, the Japanese, the transient workers, all of these stuff, and the reservations. And you see this archipelago of gulags, much like people kind of visualize in Stalinist Russia. In British Columbia, you had hundreds of these camps that people were sent to in the middle of nowhere.
I can explain why they're,
please,
why Indian reserves. Because Indian reserves, if you look at the history of the establishment of Indian reserves, were always established on the worst land. And so the land around Indian reserves is the land that nobody's claimed anywhere. Right? And so it's low quality land, not much use for anything. And that's why it's free. That's why it's available. And so the juxtaposition with Indian reserves simply is simply because they put these people the same place they put Indians, where nobody wants the land. No. No, as a matter of fact, they bought land in Dexter Indian Reserve. There was nothing that ever stopped them. And as a matter of fact, you find in the history, if you look at Indian Reserves over time, you'll find that over time, the best land from Indian Reserves was carved off by what you said. And the amount of good land on an Indian Reserve, this is usually marked on the surveyor's map. They'll say which is the good land, which is the lousy land. You'll see that over time, the good land has all been claimed by white settlers, and the Indians are no longer living there. It wasn't because people didn't want to live near Indian reserves. It was because the land was the worst land available. That's why Indians were there.
Yeah, I saw this map where it's got like the arounds of the reserve, like this land's good for mining, maybe not, and that was like done in the 30s and 40s, so they had their eye on the pie that was to come.
Not conspiracy theory, I used to teach Aboriginal people in the law and the land question in British Columbia. This is stuff that I studied for decades.
So I found the Hudson's Bay stuff, thanks Theo. It was in something else. It was in the Vancouver Sun, and I thought I'd kind of like mix things up because sometimes these guys, like when they're talking there about like, we'd go inside these stores and it was fine. And when he talks about the Hudson's Bay, they're usually like, oh, the police totally overreacted. It wasn't that bad. Trying to maintain this public image of pacifism or, you know, trying to keep the support of pacifists and the Social Democrats. But when you read other accounts, you see the conflict rising. So I thought I'd go from one extreme to the other, being the Vancouver Sun. And so we mostly read about what happened at the heart attack event in the Vancouver Sun. If you didn't, they had great pictures. So here's their talking about the heart attack march 75 years earlier. A lot of snake marches after being repelled from stores. And then a traffic tangle occurred at Granville and Georgia Street as the marchers, paying no heed to signal lights, crossed the streets en masse. A constable attempting to clear a passage for traffic was assaulted, and an unsuccessful attempt was made to overturn his police car that was trying to assist him. The major portion of the marchers had meanwhile entered the Hudson's Bay store while the other ones were trying to flip the cop car, and they paraded around and making trouble. They were parading around and making trouble until the trouble commenced. More than 35 plate glass showcases were smashed when the strikers got out of hand while the police were just attempting to eject them from the store. Marching around the main floor, the strikers halted and refused to move for 15 minutes. Efforts by police to persuade them to leave the store quietly failed, and then the police started to hustle them out at one at a time. Several scuffles ensued as strikers resisted, and a general melee ensued. Suddenly, one of the strikers kicked in a plate glass showcase. It was a signal for an orgy of smashing, breaking their ranks. Suddenly, they ran through the aisles, smashing showcases and sweeping goods on display to the floor. In a couple of minutes, nearly 40 cases were damaged, and the police drew their batons later. Right? They didn't have the batons at first. 20 minutes later, then they pulled the batons to force the rioters from the store. in the conflict, six policemen were injured by flying missiles. One police officer was hit with an iron bar carried by a striker. Several of the strikers were hit and two were arrested, one requiring hospital treatment. Only a couple arrested. After leaving the store, the men marched to Victory Square. Detachments of provincial police and Royal Canadian Mounted Police, this is back then, were sent to help city forces in the event of disturbances at the square. So they get to Victory Square, which has been the site of several conflicts. And for this conflict, they decide, the mayor comes out, blah, 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 decides to read the Riot Act. So whatever happened, you know, a couple months ago, 75 years ago, they decide to read the Riot Act and explains here what the Riot Act is. The Riot Act is usually the last resort in handling an ugly crowd and gives the police and forces of law and order the right to use any means within their power to disperse the unlawful assembly. And in bold, they explain what that really means. It means that the police and those legally attempting to disperse the crowd may shoot down anyone resisting. The person shot has no redress. I'm going to call the BC Civil Liberties Association on you, motherfucker. You shot me in the back. That's illegal. You can't shoot him in the back. You got to shoot him in the face. After reading his rights. And then it goes on. So this happened in, when did the heart attack thing happen? That was in February. This happened in April. So after that, people were kind of sketched out. They started invoking a lot of different laws. Various levels of the government started enacting their own laws. So municipally, provincially, and federally. They looked at a lot of laws that they brought on the books during the general strike that happened in Winnipeg. In 1919. A lot of those laws hadn't been used, and they're like, oh, well, it's a good thing we put those on the books. One could argue maybe it's a good thing to put these new laws on the books now for the forthcoming revolution, the coming insurrection. So they now, in this insurrection, decided to enact these laws, read the Riot Act, shoot people if need be, or arrest them for being communists. So the hysteria of communism, besides being funny, was actually like pretty severe for these people being branded as communists, because you could be interned as a subversive and you'd have no legal representation, not like you ever really do. But in this case, you're not going to get out the next day after eating some shitty food like we do now. You're just going to sit in there. So people were pretty sketched out. The state had responded, and it took a couple months really for the relief camp workers. I'm kind of getting onto, these are the guys, the relief camp workers that are gonna go to Ottawa. So I'm almost at the Ottawa part, this is taking a while. So there's kind of like this lull, they kind of go underground. At the same time though, it should be noted, these Nazis, like real Nazis, of the National Socialist Party of Germany, they brought like a boat in to the harbor in Vancouver, and they're like, yay, we're Nazis. And like the Nazis here were like, right on Nazis, like let's have an orgy of smashing. And so they all got together at like the Moose Lodge or some shit, like actually like the Moose Lodge. And so these guys just showed up and beat the living fucking shit out of the Nazis. Like they didn't get anywhere close. Like the cops said like all they could do was try to save the Nazis. And one, it was like he was in serious condition. The other ones were just like, heads were fucking mangled. They took off and only came back in their three-piece suits. So what I'm trying to find is, and if you'll give me a moment, this is where it gets exciting. See, I lost my bookmark, but it should be right here. After a lull, they decided that something the fuck needs to happen. We need some relief. We need to get this done. And so they had a secret meeting. I think I found it. They had a secret meeting. That's not it. I'm just going to tell a story. It's a cool story. I'd say, okay, we're not going to tell anybody really what's happening. We've got this leadership. We got to do something to get relief. Enough eating rats. It tastes like, you know, whatever. I don't know what rats taste like. Doesn't taste good. We need to get something done. Here's what we're going to do. They don't tell anybody. Everybody split into crews. Crew one, crew two, crew three. They say, crew one, crew two, you go to Spencer's, crew one. Crew two, you go to Woodward. Just do this, like, stand out front. We're going to go bust in. It's all good. And crew three is hidden out at the Ukrainian lodge, which is kind of like the hangout for a lot of these commies or whoever they were. And so when the cops follow crew one and two, crew three slips away. Actually, they beeline. They're like, just down the street to the Carnegie. They walk into the Carnegie, which is the museum at the time, full of priceless fucking garbage. They go in there. They fucking right away, like, everybody get the fuck out, like, barricades down. Throw all these barricades together, freak out, blah, blah, blah. Kick some guys in the basement, some dude that they find later. Get him out, but totally lock the fucking shit down. The cops are way down at Woodward's and Spencer's, like, no idea. So by the time the pigs come back, the Carnegie, as they comment in this, there's no better building in all of Vancouver to serve as a fortress or something like that, which is still very much true today. If ever the Carnegie needed occupying, it's right now. So they occupy it. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people hear about this because there's a telephone. They're like, holy shit, we have access to a telephone. They call everybody. This is what's going down. We've taken the Carnegie. Like, holy shit. Thousands of people come. They've got, like, pitchforks. You read the police. Sorry if I'm spitting on you guys. They got pitchforks. The police talk about this. They're like, holy shit. Like, yeah, we kind of wanted to go in there, bust some heads, even if we had to break some of the ruling class's toys. But there's no way we could have gotten past all the farmers. Where the fuck did they come from? And the longshoremen who showed up and they're like, there's no way you're going to get in. Meanwhile, from the top of the Carnegie, some guy's gone out, climbed to the top. Like, if you've seen the Carnegie, everyone's seen the Carnegie. There's like that flag thing there. Some dude put a black flag on that while some other guy is like hanging out the thing with this bucket, hauling up cigarettes. And then they had to ask for aspirins because they had headaches from too much cigarettes and like bakery shit and more cigarettes. And like, they're just like sitting there in the Carnegie like, oh, this is fucking heaven, like right on. And so finally, like, the mayor, who's like literally hiding out at the yacht club. He's like, you can like imagine. He's like, he went there for lunch. He went there like before lunch. They're like, mayor, sorry to ruin you. I know you're going to have lunch, but like, they've occupied the Carnegie and they want a week's worth of relief. It wasn't until like after dinner, right? He's like hiding underneath the table, like eating dinner. Okay, fine. Grant them relief. So everybody in the Carnegie's like, fuck yeah, we got like a weekend of food vouchers. Like, this is sweet, man. And so there's the euphoria as they're leaving with everybody. Like, got my $10 crisis grant. I mean, my fucking weekend relief shit. Like, fuck yeah. They go to their office, which is on Cordova by Gallery Gachet. They go in there and kind of the euphoria subsides a bit. They're like, okay, that was hardcore. We could have gotten fucked up. And all we got is some food vouchers. We need to do something. One of the guys who's like pretty outspoken in the meetings, he gets up. He says, we need to get intense. We need to get more militant. We need to fuck some shit up. This is going nowhere. What are we going to do? Like, and somebody's like saying, you know, if we're going to take on the government, we need a dagger in our teeth and muskets. So things are starting to kind of like, oh, you know, shit might start going down. A lot of people are really good with explosives. They're blowing up a lot of shit in the relief camps because they actually train these hobos how to blow up tree stumps. Like, you go into Dockside now or like one of the PHS buildings, they're not teaching you explosives. So they're like, there's people like, let's fucking get it on, man. Like, we just had like 50 fucking thousand people with pitchforks, like ready to drive the fucking pigs out. Let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do this. Then, okay, this is my conspiracy theory. Pardon me, teachers who are there. Total conspiracy theory. I didn't bring my evidence with me. That I forgot home. Who needs evidence? They're in this meeting. Something's got to be done. And then somebody in the back, nobody knows who it is in everybody's accounts. First, they tried to attribute it to the leader. He said afterwards it wasn't me. Somebody in the back goes like, on to Ottawa? Everyone's like, oh, Ottawa. Well, maybe we can take our demands to Ottawa. Yeah, fuck, why not go to Ottawa? Yeah, totally, we can go there. We can fuck shit up in Ottawa. Yeah, we can get on the freight trains and go there. It'll be awesome. We can ride the freight, get the fuck out of here. Yeah, totally, we can go to Ottawa, set up a Soviet after we throw all those fuckers out of Parliament and then federize it across Canada and all the other communist parties. That's a great idea. Pretty good idea, but what I want to interject here, and this is kind of controversial to the few geeks, is that, again, nobody knows who said on to Ottawa. What everybody knows is that meeting in particular was like half full with fucking rats, pigs, provocateurs, every type of fucking social scum was sitting inside that meeting on behalf of not just the piggery itself, but also the capitalist pigs at the docks who wanted nothing more than this industrial reserve army to get the fuck out of Vancouver. Like, their office is right beside where this dock strike is going. Whenever the dock strikers get off their fat asses and go on picket duty, they pay stipends, or whatever the Women's Center in Vancouver, I mean, whoever does, gets stipends to pay these poor people to come and stand there and be tough and get in confrontations. If they could get rid of that Industrial Reserve Army, send them to Ottawa or wherever the fuck, then it's just going to be them and the fucking dock workers, and they outnumber the dock workers, and they're going to fuck those dock workers up. So, keeping that in mind, yeah, on to Ottawa. Yeah, great idea. People are like, fuck it. I think there's a lot of different reasons why they left. I think most people are like, fuck Vancouver. Like, this city kind of sucks. I don't know why you're still here. Like, there's a few of you I know why you're still here, but really, it's like, come on. Let's get the fuck out of here. Let's go to Ottawa. There's also reports where guys are like, we were never going to make it to Ottawa. Like, never. There will never be a black president of America. We're never going to make it to Ottawa. This is never going to happen. Like, fuck that. But most of the guys are just like, fuck it, let's get out of here. So just to keep it in with that kind of strike on the docks, the day that they left BC, the RCMP attacked the docks and crushed the revolt and just like literally beat the fucking living hell out of everybody. Like, the day that they left the province, is almost as if it was coordinated, orchestrated, conspired upon, and quite brutal and violent. But that's just a conspiracy theory. I won't dwell on it. What is interesting, though, is this actual trip to Ottawa. And why I'm kind of going about in this, what do you call it, like timeline, like chronological way, is I'm trying to map the trajectory of these home bums in the 30s, these guys in hobo jungles, to the slave camps, to Vancouver. Now they're leaving Vancouver, they're getting back on the freight trains that they came in on, literally the same place, going back to the hobo jungles, getting back on the freight trains, and leaving Vancouver to go to Ottawa. So I have some people talking about it, but I'm just gonna bypass that. I think I'm doing fine. Is this okay? Thank you. Okay, can you see that okay? Everybody, because this is a cool fucking picture. What I was gonna read was this news, you know, I'm gonna look for it, if I can find it quick, because it's kind of funny. A news report of them leaving from the Hobo Jungle, which next week we have a play at this Hobo Jungle reenacting the Onto Ottawa Trek departure. I'm gonna talk about that afterwards, but just so you remember. I thought I had it. Got it. So it's not like, I even reading the shit for the 100th time, I'm just like, the numbers, the sheer mass, the critical mass, the near critical mass, or I like George Bataille's slogan for it, the popular front on the streets, just the magnitude of the mob, I think is best described after, you know, months of setbacks and ruptures. These are the people who are going to leave everything, or nothing, as the case for many of them are, and go on to Ottawa, on to the batons. This is a guy talking about it, and then it's going to go into the province. The strikers left Vancouver as scheduled on June 3rd. Is that today or is that tomorrow? Yeah, see, yeah. Close, doing this tonight, it's kind of like, if tomorrow we wanted, if you're so inspired, tomorrow we can like go hop on a train that's not going to move anywhere. The strikers left Vancouver tomorrow in two groups of men. They were to meet at Kamloops, where they would stay for a couple days and then keep going. About 700 left on the CPR freight at 8:30 and were followed by another 200 who boarded a CNR freight about midnight. Another group, estimated at 400, left Vancouver the next night to join the trek. This is some fucking scumbag from the province, but I think it's written nice. As the locomotive, speaking for the train, as the locomotive of the 90 car train started its deep coughing in an endeavor to put into motion its huge load, there was a cheer from its horde of uninvited passengers who clung to the tops of the cars like swarming bees. The cheer was answered by the large crowd, composed of all classes, kind of important, of Vancouver citizenry, who lined it, who were there, blah, 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 blah. So a shitload get on these trains. They start heading out through, as I was mentioning earlier, if you look at BC, especially along the train lines in a kind of cynical way like me and Theo, You see it, as I said, like this archipelago of gulags. So they now have this army of hobos, now like army of communistic hobos, riding on all these freight trains, stopping at every fucking slave camp, every ghost town, every fucking shithole, and hundreds of people are joining them. They're like, fuck yeah, convergence. I think right now there's probably a lot of people doing the same. Maybe there's like an on to fucking Toronto trek happening to embarrass the apparatus of security, as I saw in the metro. People, this is just a big convergence for people to go to. Not much has really changed in the style of activism. Shit's going to go down there. Let's go there together and fuck shit up there. Jello Biafra, riot in somebody else's town. Tomorrow you're homeless. Tonight it's a blast. So that's their idea. But they're stopping. They're making friends. They're having like festivals. They're getting wasted. They're getting laid. They're fucking loving it in each town they go to because they are the shit. And at the same time, though, they're back to eating rats because it's like hungry. There's not a Starbucks on the train. So they decide that in these stops that they're going to need to get back to the dirty work and demand some relief. And the way that they would do that is that they would storm the government office and take everybody hostage with whatever weapons that they had and demanded like some bread or a couple food vouchers so that they could go to the restaurant, and then like we promised we'd leave. So there's this like guy who just got taken hostage at a government place, and he calls his like alderman or whatever. He's like, I don't know, regarding British Columbia single men, a dangerous revolutionary army intimidating and defying provincial and municipal governments by threats and actually holding officials as hostage until demands are met is not a good thing. Their success having a far-reaching effect that may be difficult to control. This message went out across the wire. Every government agency, every fucking hack that worked in any government institution was afraid that they too were going to be taken hostage. That fear and legitimate paranoia was obviously answered by the higher levels of authority, the apparatus of control, the apparatus of repression that was highly sophisticated at the time in putting down isolated ruptures that happen in one place, deal with it. They weren't able at that time to respond to this kind of like nomadic army that was moving fucking fast, stopping wherever they want, forge whatever the fuck they need, get back in their war machine and keep going. So what they did was invent a whole new apparatus of control. And looking, I'll spend hours if I start reading from this. I'm just going to show it to you if I can find it. It's a little book. I have it somewhere, believe me. It has all, so this guy went and he got all the Freedom of Information Act stuff about the government and what they were going to do. In it, what I'll say, so as not to get going about it, is looking at that and also studying how the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit was put together, you see a lot of similarities in that, holy shit, what the fuck are we going to do? We don't really have a totality of repression. We really need to bring all of these antagonistic entities of the state machinery. You know, it's all one. It's a totality in itself, but bureaucracies kind of conflict. We need to bring these together in direct communication so that we can transport troops quickly to crush these motherfuckers. So what they do here for the first time, and there's kind of examples of when this came to be. First, there was like the Louis Riel uprising where they had to send the army out over trains that hadn't been built. So they got in deals with the government and business and built the trains. Blah, blah, blah. Then there's the Nanaimo coal strikes, which we had pictures of earlier, where they sent the army to crush them with a little bit of help of the police. But now what they were able to do was to unify the relief workers, welfare workers, with the city cops, with the provincial cops, with the federal cops, and now with the army, all under the jurisdiction of the RCMP. So not to get too into it, but if you look at VISU, the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit, exact same fucking thing. They didn't invent nothing new for this 2010. They just went back to this shit, or, you know, it evolved, not to say it was just from this, but this apparatus was put into place to deal with the On to Ottawa trek, to deal with it as a totality of repression, how to destroy a nomadic army. And they were quite efficient, is what I'm going to get to now. So, okay, so in these stocks, I was going to point it out, but it's too big. There's like this guy from the RCMP who's a fucking fascist nut. Like there's always like those fascist nuts, like the Dave Jones of the Business Improvement Association, whoever in VZ, like the real motherfuckers who believe in fascism. and come up with like the craziest ideas, and like the moderate fascists are all like, I don't know, that seems kind of fascist. Why don't we just put them and turn them in camps or something? Why don't we just buy the hotels of the downtown east side and put them in there? Like, what's that? So this guy, so okay, as an example, his idea was, okay, so we got this train coming through. When they're all out partying, getting laid and getting drunk, we'll switch the trains. And on the train, now we'll have a bunch of cops, and we'll drive them out, but we'll take them on this other thing, and they'll be in the middle of nowhere, and then they'll surround them with the guns, and then we'll bring them out, and we'll be like, ah, and we'll put them in a military concentration camp. Everyone's like, that's a good idea. I could see that. We've done it. We could do that again. How about, though, if we just negotiate with their leaders? And they're like, whoa, the fascists were like, whoa, that's the way we're going to do it. We're going to negotiate with the leadership that has never been established. In this relief camp workers union, they had always had, like, each meeting was facilitated by a different person. So there's kind of like this central democracy, Olivek Lenin and all that, really happening. But the facade was of a real communistic democracy where at least the symbolic positions of authority, you know, they traded up. So they said, okay, well, the state is who I mean by we. Whatever that's called. I always say we, but Kara reminded me that you actually have to say who the bad guys are. You know, Batman doesn't just always fight somebody. Batman fights Catwoman or something. There's a word for it. Thank you, Kara. So they say, we're going to negotiate with four of you people. Get to Regina, take it easy. We'll give you some crisis grants, some relief tickets. We'll negotiate with only four of you. But you get to negotiate with the Prime Minister of Canada. And they're like, whoa, the Prime Minister of Canada. They talk about it. They're like, we're not really going to get anything, but at least we can hang out in Regina, which is sympathetic. We can keep drinking. We can maybe meet some people. How's it going, bro? And we'll just take it easy because we're going to get there. Everything's going to be fine. The guys go to Regina. The Prime Minister's there, surrounded by cops, and the Prime Minister's just like, and they're like, whoa, dude. Like, what the fuck's that all about? Like, what's going on? And he's like, you fools! While you came here, we sent all our troops that way. You probably went right fucking by them. We sent all our troops to Regina, where, that's where the RCMP is. After the whole Louis Riel rebellion, we just kept them there in Central Canada. So we've already got all those troops. Now we've brought all of our soldiers to Regina while you're sitting here talking to the Prime Minister. And they're like, fuck. Like, we've been totally fucked. Let's get out of here. They stopped the negotiations, pretty much like flipped the table. They didn't necessarily flip the table, but they're like, fuck you. We're out. Too late. Go back to Regina. By the time they get there, the city is surrounded by the military. So the peripheral of the city is the military. Inside, police, state, cops everywhere, RCMP, everything. And they're just standing there with guns like, welcome back, boys. Like, right on. So they come in, they're like, we are fucked, this is insane. They've enacted these laws, the trains aren't allowed to go anywhere. They're like, we will bomb the trains, like, you cannot leave. Like, we will open fucking fire. They got Gatling guns, on the fucking trains. They're like, yeah, come on, like, hop on this train, motherfucker, like, I dare you. They're like sitting there, shit, our leaders are backed, we got totally fucked over, we need to do something different, this is not going to work. They sit around, they have a meeting, and they decide, whilst in Regina, that they need to come up with a new strategy. So, could you please, you guys, the rest of us will stay here and watch the baseball game. Half of you guys go downtown. Here's the boys. You guys go downtown, hold a meeting with the people of Regina who've been super sweet to us, and tell them the trek is postponed. We don't know what the fuck to do. Who really knows what the story is, but it is postponed. So what happens is what has been called by some as the Regina Riot. Why did that happen? Because the cops, just leave those. I might get you to help me out with some of these slides though, if you don't mind. You came late, so you're like the slide helper out guy. So the Regina Riot. Remember that trippy picture I had at the beginning for you who were here on time? That's kind of like a close-up, just kind of whetting your appetite for the Regina Riot. They go into town, they hold a meeting, to tell, can everybody see that? To tell their friends, their comrades, their supporters that there's not going to be any on Ottawa track right now. We need to figure some shit out. Thanks, everybody. It's been a good night. See you later. As they finish the speech, all these trucks fucking pull up, full of fucking pigs. They kick open the back doors. They charge the crowd. And as soon as they hit the crowd, they kind of, I'll get into it. But what I want to point out, as soon as they hit the crowd, the one cop, maybe the first cop, is just torn to fucking pieces. Just ribbons. Just fucking mutilated by the first fucking communist that he hits. And I mention that because always in these books, like, oh, the boys are well-disciplined. As soon as the rupture erupted, they're like, see you, communist discipline. Like, we're going to rip you to pieces, you fascist fucking pigs. That was history. You know? Fetishize what you will. So I'm going to read a few things of this bunch of guys talked about the riot. I'm going to put it together. I kind of look more for the tactical stuff. So bear with me. Does anybody want another beer? Is anybody getting a beer?
I want a beer.
There's beer over there, $3 to $5. Feel free to get up, you know. I'm going to go over and get a beer.
Did you say you buy people beer?
If people don't have money,
I
that's all good. That's all good. Just let them, tell them Dave sent you. If you can grab me one too. Does anybody want to get a beer? This is the riot part. This is what you came for. This is the money shot. Really? I'll wait for you. Get a beer.
Michael.
Oh, Climax Killers. I was joking. This is part of the improvisation. Terrible. All right, I'm not. Fuck these alcoholics. You are my people. Here's the people talking about it. Dominion Day. Oh, yeah. It happened on Dominion Day. Canada Day, whenever that is. July 1st. Canada Day. Fitting. Dominion Day. Our country's birthday. And what a celebration it turned out to be. There were probably 400 or 500 of us at the market square. The meeting wasn't long underway when four large furniture vans pulled up. A shrill whistle blast out the signal and out poured the Mounties. In the first mad shouting clubbing charge, Regina Detective Miller was killed. In less than minutes, the market square was a mass of writhing, groaning forms, like a battlefield. On the streets, we assembled under group leaders. Remember, they had their shit down. Squads, groups, you know your shit. On the street, we assembled under group leaders into a column, and we started our march back to the fairgrounds. Remember, everybody else is over there, where we still had 200. Oh, we marched our way back to the fairgrounds. We were told of 200 horsemen, 200 pigs on horses, lined across the street in front of us. It was gonna be a squeeze play. Immediately, orders were given to build barricades, and there was plenty of material to work with. The street was lined with parked cars, and we simply pushed them into the streets, turned them on the sides, and piled them too high. They're fucking big back then, like fucking huge hobos. Those rats, it's the rats, man. The cars were lighter back then. It was the depression, no gas. The barricades were built quickly, solidly across the street from wall to wall, with one narrow opening wide enough for one man to pass through at a time. And we built quite a few, a couple hundred feet apart. It was then, before the first futile charge was made by the Mounties, that the magical happened. The young boys and some girls of Regina organized our ammunition column. Without being asked, they came riding bicycles in from side streets, their carrier baskets loaded with rocks, which they dumped behind the barricades, and then rode off for another load. Our defense was simple. Keep it fucking simple. In front of the barricade, two lines formed, each with a good armful of rocks, brought by the kids. I've got two girls. They would come with the rocks. They've been taught. So it was simple, two rows, each with, everybody get a rock, get a rock. As the horsemen charged, the front rank let go a barrage of rocks, then fell to their knees. And the row behind them just threw the rocks too. Makes sense. Bam. Bam, keep picking them up, keep throwing them. Besides this main battle, there were skirmishes going on all over downtown. Once in a lull between the charges, this is hours, right? Like downtown is now on fire. Once in a lull between charges, a large group of trekkers came around the corner in front of us, flushed with victory and led by a guy wearing a Mountie's tin hat with the Mounties club swinging at his wrist. Fuck yeah, man! Let's fucking lose that shit, man. That's fucking awesome. On to Ottawa! Woo! At one intersection where some of our men with lots of rocks were keeping at bay a squad of Mounties on foot, the Mounties tried tear gas. But, and this is constant, they fired them into the wind and the boys picked up the gas shells and lobbed them back at the fucking, at the Mounties. It was here that the police fired the first revolver shot. That's not working. Try this out. Reminds me when I was in Genoa. It was here that the police fired the first revolver shot, the first casualty being, this wasn't the case in Genoa, an innocent bystander. That night, 40 trekkers received gunshot wounds. It was a terrible night. Downtown lay in shambles. Not a store window was left. The streets piled up with rocks and broken glass, dozens of cars piled up with no glass in them, and twisted fenders and bodies. Around 10 o'clock, the police started to withdraw from the streets. They were exhausted and demoralized. Imagine, you just got your fucking ass handed to you by a bunch of home bums. It was decided that we'd break into groups, scatter, and get back to the headquarters at the exhibition grounds. So they realized that there was nowhere to go. They couldn't get out. They're now trapped in Regina. They go back to the fairgrounds just because that was just the idea, right? Like, get back to our headquarters. They're there. They're like, holy shit. Morning comes. They're totally surrounded now by the RCMP, by the military. They bring into the fairgrounds, which Althea and I have been to. It's like a fucking super surreal place. They bring into the fairgrounds trains, again, with the fucking Gatling guns on top, and they're like, you've got a one-way ticket the fuck out, right? Like, get in. So they're all like, you know, what can we do? They start negotiating through hunger strikes, a couple fights here and there. They say, okay, well, we'll leave so long as we determine where we're going to go. Like, you can't just send us all back to Vancouver because Vancouver fucking sucks. So maybe I'll go to Toronto. Maybe I'll do this. Maybe I'll do that. Some guys, and I have a newspaper report here, they decided that they were just going to skip out and hijack a train, which is pretty fucking cool. So some people went to Toronto. I'm getting to the Spain thing, that whole trajectory, the cartology of this like 30s thing. So before we get there, some people go here, some people go there, some people do this, some people hijack a fucking train. I'm only going to read it because I've read all this shit. I never heard about the train, but it's in the newspaper, so it's got to be real. And like, this is so cryptic. So it's like, what actually happened? According to whoever the fuck this is, the province. Greased rails brought a freight train to a stop on a steep grade near Golden, BC, Tuesday afternoon, and 60 relief camp strikers boarded it and assumed control, police said. The strikers, who had held a demonstration in Golden earlier that day, had greased the tracks, and when the train, on the main line of the CPR, was forced to halt, they climbed aboard. 28 of the men were caught in a police trap at the railway yards here this morning, the rest having escaped the officers by jumping the train and to the outskirts of town. Those in custody, blah, blah, blah. That's all it says about the event. Kind of weird. Just thought I'd share with you. No big. Take it easy. Well, that's what I don't really... I think they're in Golden. They seized it. Like, I just seized the train. Like, fucking train robbers. 40 of them seized the fucking train. They're like, ah, give me the fucking train, motherfucker, everybody out! Everybody gets out because now they're driving the train. So it sounds like they're driving the train. And then the police trap them. I don't know what the trap is. And the people who got away jumped off the freight train. Jumped off the train. I only bring it up because it's interesting to me and a couple of others. But also just to say, but by no means was the trek dissolved. I have a quote in there of somebody else talking about when everybody got back to Vancouver, people weren't really demoralized. They're like, that was pretty good. Like, holy fuck, man. Like, we fucked Regina up. That trip on the train is pretty sweet. Most people were able to get the fuck out. But, you know, it's still the Depression. It's 1935. This kind of fucking sucks. My buddy got shot by the fascists. I don't really like fascism so much. I didn't know what it was. I just lived this existence under fascism. But now I'm hearing these rumblings of the fascist war in Spain. Something is happening in Spain. All of these communist guys who have been kind of leeching parasitically to us and like spouting all this weird shit, they're talking about Spain more and more, and it's making more sense to me. When they fire a bullet at a fascist in Spain, it's like firing a bullet at a fascist here. That was kind of the internationalism. A fascist is a fascist. And the real militaristic fascists were taking over in Spain. So what happened in Canada, at least, which sent the second largest contingent of folk to Spain, they sent 1,700 people to Spain. 600 of those people were from, and you know, 600, 500, I get my numbers confused, a shitload of them, hundreds and hundreds, came from BC. We're on the onto Ottawa track. Their trek continued past Regina, fuck Ottawa. It went to the anti-fascist offensive that was happening in Spain. And how it happened was pretty interesting. And I really, I forgot all these slides. I don't really want to talk too much about Spain because I have been talking so fucking much. And also, I'm working more on Spanish stuff. Spain is a very complex, fucked up, insane, crazy thing, laden with contradictions and insanities and that weird shit. If you've tried to read about Spain, if you've spent at least 50 hours trying to read about Spain, you still really don't know what's happening. Oh, okay, this one. Oh, I should have had this one on earlier. Detective Miller getting his head ripped off. This thing, okay, so look at this guy. Guy with the stick. Is he beating a corpse with a stick, or did he just beat that guy to death? I don't know. Fetishize what you will. This guy, he's dead. Pelt him with rocks. Fucking mutilate his corpse. All these guys just beating on a dead horse, dead pig, whatever. This guy, he's going to be fine. He's totally fine. You're going to make it, bro. Do you see any other cops helping this guy? So four vanloads of cops come. Right away, a cop gets killed. One fucking cop, the other just runs. They're fighting back. Go figure, eh? Okay. Oh, I showed you that close up. Okay, so Spain, I'm trying to ease my way out of Spain because really I feel right now I could talk about it quite a bit. So what I'm going to talk about for Spain, if you don't mind just a little bit, quickly. And I think this helps, if we will, personify this trajectory I keep talking about. There's this guy, Bill Williamson. That's not your granddad, is it, my friend? No? Okay. So this guy wasn't just the first Canadian in Spain. He was the first motherfucker in Spain. And how this happened was he left the On to Ottawa trek after joining the relief workers that were interned in those camps from the IWW. He ran away from home, from Winnipeg when he was 14, hopped on freight trains, went all over the place, ended up going to BC because he heard shit was going down. Went to Ottawa, went onto the trek to Regina, to the Batons. Afterwards, he went to Toronto and decided that he was going to go to Shanghai, summit hopping. At this time, sorry, this ulcer. I guess it wasn't so much summit hopping back then, it was like wide-scale insurrection hopping. Because at Shanghai, there was this failed, go figure, insurrection that was happening. Huge blood on the streets had been happening for quite some time. He heard about it. He had worked on boats before. He got a job on big boat and went to Shanghai, got there. And so everything was happening. It's kind of like if you went to Thailand a couple weeks ago. He's like standing around like, where the fuck is everything? Like, I can't find it. Nobody's talking to me. I don't speak Shanghai-y. Like, what the fuck? So he's like, this kind of sucks. There's nothing to do. I can't find where the insurrection is happening. At this time, everybody had been killed. And the communists had moved up north and, you know, all this type of stuff. I won't get into that. So he's like, bummer. He goes to Australia. Not too far away. Goes to Australia. He hears that there's a bunch of anarchists in Australia. He'd heard about anarchists. He heard that there was this anarchist space on 12th and Clark in Australia. He goes there because they're playing movies. Well, I don't know if they'd play... Okay, I always pronounce his name wrong. Eisenstein, Russian film director. They're playing an Eisenstein film fest. He shows up, he sees, and if you haven't seen it, it's like, holy fuck, Battleship Potemkin. Battleship Potemkin! It's fucking subtitled. I watch it in Russian. I didn't even watch it with the subtitles, right? I just watched the fucking original. So he sees that shit and like, okay, so there's this one thing. I can see him sitting there. There's this scene where they're on this boat. It's like these guys, kind of like them, like in the camps, but they're on a boat. They're interned on a boat. They're forced into slave labor onto the boat. and there's no meat. So just like in the camps where they rioted for cigarettes, they rioted for good meat, they riot on this boat, and the camp guard, I mean the PHS staff, I mean the captain of the boat, comes up and he says, "What's wrong with the meat?" So this is this great thing. "What's wrong with the meat?" And they're all like, "There's fucking maggots in the meat, man. Like, look at this fucking meat. It's writhing with maggots. You want to see that?" He looks at it, he's like, "That's not maggots. Fly's eggs. What's your fucking problem?" Okay, so he sees that. He's like, "Whoa, that's totally the case." But he doesn't say whatever. He says, "I want to go and work with this guy. He'll have me. He's a communist. He's a good guy. He's from the Bolshevik Revolution. I want to learn how to take pictures. I'm going to go there and take pictures with him. How do I get there? I don't know. Maybe I should get back on this boat and sail around until I can finally get to Russia." Gets on a boat. He goes to England. He's like, "Okay, I got a better chance of going to Russia from here." He's at the port. There's a strike going on. All the Spaniards are freaking out. What's happening? "Oh, there's been this uprising in Spain." "Oh, really? Spain, communist. Maybe that'll get me to Russia. Maybe Eisenstein will be there. I'm going to go to Spain." Turns out he's the first guy, first internationalist. Maybe there's some French people there that got in. But he was, you know, the first, you know, Anglo-Saxon, Plains of Abraham, real guy, gets in, breaks the barricade. He's with, like, all these people on the boat. They're Spaniards on the boat, right? They're like, "Oh, you're cool. You're on the Ontario track. Come with us. Totally smuggle yourself on, right on." They go in, and, like, they breach the what does Israel have? Their naval barricade. What's it called? Blockade? So a bunch of Zionists don't come on and shoot them. Flotilla. It's kind of like a flotilla. I think there was a couple boats. There you go. The flotillas were to come. This guy's before the flotillas. He's like the guy who's like digging the tunnels like from Egypt into Gaza, like one of the first. He shows up. He shows up in Spain, the first guy. He's got a camera that he just got after pawning his like boots or whatever. And he starts taking photographs, which end up being the first photographs of the Spanish Civil War. So I've got a few of those photographs. It's just beautiful to read about it. I'll only read a couple parts. Okay, so he says all these beautiful things. I'm going to get to his lover and all this stuff. But he also says something pretty dorky, which is also kind of gorgeous. So I'm going to read that, and I'll kind of leave it there. So he's coming in. Is this the thing? Oh, yeah. He's coming in on this boat. They're out in the harbor. They got to wait. They got to make the signal. Like, is it safe to come in? All we see is a bunch of crazy people with guns. Are those the fascists or the anti-fascists? Are those the fascists or the Stalinists? No, but at that time, you know, Stalinists hadn't really taken over. Well, who is this? And I looked down into the square at that time. It must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And all the girls were dancing in their summer dresses. And many of them in their summer dresses on had a rifle on their shoulder and a red band around their arm. And I thought it was almost sacrilege in a way, because they were dancing to the strains of the Internationale. And above everything else, I remember cars and trucks racing through the streets with their headlights on in bright daylight, and the sirens going around and sounding really loud. And all the time there was this terrific hubbubaloo. It was almost as if it was the Russian Revolution happening all over again. This is the day after the Republican forces announced that whatever the fuck, the Civil War is on. So he shows up to all this hubbubaloo, this insurgent euphoria that's happening. He's got a camera. He's taking pictures of these blasphemous ladies dancing. It wasn't, you know, that they had rifles. It was, of course, that they were dancing and laughing to the Internationale, which is a very somber song. That's him, the big guy. This is Bill. He comes in. He ends up staying for quite some time, but for the first 2 months, he stayed after meeting on the first day this woman. They became lovers. 2 months later, they got sent to different fronts. The first day on her new front, she was blown up. We got a letter from her friend saying that she'd been killed in action. He was totally devastated, obviously. He continues on. This is where I could really talk a lot about the Canadian or the Trekkers' involvement in Spain, but I'm going to try to hold off. Because he comes to this conclusion that so many did, or so many went there, with the understanding that they weren't going to be controlled by the communist forces that had kind of brought them there. They showed up like after this trek to Toronto, to Guelph, to wherever the fuck. Basing stations were in Ontario. They're like, if you want to go to Spain, get the fuck out of here. We'll give you $5, you know, a meal voucher. We'll send you to New York. So like all these home bums were like, you know, hundreds and hundreds, ends up being, you know, 1,600. Are like, fuck yeah, man. Like, get the fuck out of here. Free ride to Spain. A meal voucher. Whoa. So they go down to New York. They're like, fucking in New York. It's like right on, right? Everyone's like, way to go, guys. We've heard about you. You're the on to Ottawa track guys. You're the motherfucking rowdies who came in. Like, right on. They make a lot of observations that the Americans who went over were college folks, universities, Jews from the lower Manhattan East Side or whatever that's called. Whereas these guys, for the most part, almost half of them were from Ukraine, Hungary. They had fought in World War I. They had been in internment camps. They'd been on the trek. They knew how to use a gun. And everybody's like, that's cool. Like, I want to get behind you. So from New York, and I'm going to be kind of quick here, they sent them on a steamboat, not a steamboat, you know, across the ocean. Big boat. Big, it's a huge fucking boat. Massive boat. Full of them. They're all on it together. They're like, at first they talk about it, they're like, because the communists are like, don't tell anybody you're going to Spain. Because it's illegal for Canadians to go to Spain. Go to jail. You get caught, you go to jail. People went to jail. They're on the boat. They're all like these bums. But they like put their hat on straight, put up the collar, like, oh, I'm not going to Spain. They got no luggage, right? Like, oh. And they're like surrounded by like another 1,000 guys. They're all like, oh, it's all good. And then they're finally like, holy shit, man, like, there's a fucking bar here, man, we got like $5, like, we're on to Spain, like, woo, they're partying it up, this is fucking great, we're on our way to fucking France, they get off the boat, they get into France, everyone's sitting there waiting for them, come in, bonjour, bonjour, Alevec, fucking some champagne, woo, they're like, fuck yeah, champagne, they're chugging champagne, this is fucking awesome, everyone's like, you're from the trek, they're like, fucking A, rates them from the trek, like, yeah, more champagne, they get hammered, this guy's talking about getting laid left, right, and center, like, in these hotels in Paris, they're like, oh my god, this is fucking awesome, they're having a swell time, and then they're like, time to go to Spain, like, all right, sure, you know, like, not so cool, it sounded good before, we'll go to Spain, sure, so it's really a war, oh yeah, they're a war, carpet bombings, going on. They're good. Sure, good Spain. You get on the train. They have to smuggle themselves because France at the time had closed the border. Everybody had isolated what was happening in Spain. The communists in Russia weren't giving them anything. Nobody's giving anybody anything. It was just the Canadians and some Jews from New York and a couple other wacko French people who had showed up at this time. So they make their way to the border. They get out and they walk. And I have this thing, but maybe it'll take me some time to read, so maybe I won't. They walk into Spain through the mountains. When I was 17, I went to Spain and saw these mountains. When I was 17, I read this book about the Spanish Civil War. I thought the Spanish Civil War was going on, so I got my dad to sign me this thing with my friend so that I could go to Spain and see the Spanish Civil War. And when I got there, there was no Spanish Civil War, but I ended up being in the Basque region, like in fucking 1999 or 98 or whatever, when the ETA was just like blowing the fucking shit out of everything. I was like, whoa, man, Spanish Revolution, like, right on, this is a civil war. Didn't really get it, but I went into the mountains, kind of San Sebastian, up here, there, around, and it's like, whoa, man, like, those mountains are fucking hardcore. And so these guys talk about like a couple hundred of them will meet at night because they got to get past the border guards, and they got to like tiptoe. They didn't have, like, I went and saw my friend Matt on Denman Island. Everybody's got those, like, lights on their heads. You know what I mean? Like, unicorns shining these lights. You know what I mean? People got flashlights, but no flashlights. No, none of those things. No MEC. Nothing. 30s. Depression. So it's pitch black, and they're on, like, goat trails. They can't even take the goat trails because the fucking fascists are looking for them. They're walking. There's, like, 200 of them. Dozens of them are falling off the cliff and fucking dying. All they hear is, like, no partisani! They die. It's pretty bad. This other guy who's talking about going in, he took a boat. He's like, fuck those idiots. I'm not crossing that shit. I'm just smoking myself in on a boat. He's on a boat. It's all good. On a boat. Drinking beer. On a boat. Oh my god. Fascist sub. Torpedo. Kaboom. Most of them die on the boat. So then there's these other guys. They make it in. They're like, oh, totally, man. anarchist army, this is going to go well. Have a gun? No gun. Where's the front? I don't know. The front line is everywhere, man.
That's right.
Fuck yeah. They're like, okay, so now what? And they're like, okay, there's a truck. Get on that truck, go there, go that way. And there's going to be a war. It's going to be fucking crazy. Kill a fascist, take their gun. Okay, we did the trek. We can do that. They get on the fucking thing. Boom, there's like 25 Canadians and a bunch of others. Get on the truck. Maybe they go that way. Maybe they go that way. Into the fascist camp. They're all taken out and executed. So the somber reality set in pretty quick for a lot of people who showed up into Spain. The fact that almost half of the people who went there from Canada were killed. A lot of them were wounded. A lot of them were, you know, just, you know, killed by fascists. It's a special kind of killing when the fascists get you. I have a lot of different accounts, but like I said, I could get too far into it. I have a autobiography. Remember I showed you that first addiction, Ronald Liver's Edge book? So he wrote a memoir of his time into Spain. And it's big and it's crazy and it's taking me forever to transcribe. I get a feeling now of how long it takes my other friends to transcribe shit, but this is like 400 pages. So right now I'm working on transcribing it. I've kind of done this On to Ottawa track thing because it's the 75th anniversary. Next year, it's the 75th anniversary for the Spain thing. So maybe I will give a long-winded rant about Spain then. But I just wanted to introduce, as far as, again, the trajectory, that the On to Ottawa track never really existed in and of itself. It was a militant movement that was complicated, complex. Several demands were coming out of it. A lot of blood and gore and death and tragedy, but also a lot of beautiful moments. Like I think like some of these pictures, and I could keep going. I could give some big soliloquy about Spain and all this, but I'm just going to stop there. And hopefully we can drink and talk more, but I'm kind of getting a little bit emotional. And you know, now I'm going to start shit talking some other stuff. So I'm just going to stop. Thank you. Thank you.
This is a public service from the Vancouver Media Co-op. Please consider becoming a Media Co-op sustainer at vancouver.mediacoop.ca.